I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In what came as kind of a surprise yesterday, much maligned Kansas Republican Kris Kobach announced he's running for Senate. You'll recall Kobach was defeated in his last statewide race last year by now Governor Laura Kelly, and he's gotten flack from Republicans at home and in Washington. Today, the path to Pat Roberts' seat in the U.S. Senate. We'll review Kobach's pluses and minuses and ask who else might throw their hat in the race. Then, this spring had no shortage of rain and cooler than usual temps, but it's had an outsized impact on outdoor activities, lakes and streams, and wildlife throughout the region. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Former Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach is back in the public spotlight, this time as a candidate for the U.S. Senate from Kansas. Speaking in Leavenworth yesterday, Kobach took aim at the issue he's been known for, illegal immigration, as well as the leftward tilt of the Democratic Party and the failure of Republican leaders to back President Trump. Said Kobach, President Trump needs a senator who will lead the charge for him. But already some Republicans in Kansas and in Washington are lining up against him, saying his failed run for governor last year suggests that he's not the right candidate in a state that tilts Republican by 2-1. One of our guests today says that the governor's race may not have been the right fit for Kobach. A Senate race makes perhaps more sense. With us today, Bob Beatty. He made that comment. He's a professor of political science at Washburn University in Topeka. Bob, it's always good to have you. Welcome.
Oh, good to be here.
Stephen Kranda is also with us. He's a State House Bureau Chief for Kansas Public Radio. He covered Kobach's kickoff yesterday. Stephen, good morning.
Hi there.
Well, you were in Leavenworth yesterday, Stephen. Describe the event, if you would, for us and how Kris Kobach was received.
Well, it was a friendly crowd, somewhere in the range of maybe like 50 people. It was a small gathering, but a lot of energy there. These were diehard Kobach people because it was kind of short notice for the event, and they definitely were happy to hear what he said. So a very friendly crowd there and very energized for him to make this new run.
Bob, are you surprised by Kobach's entrance into this race or not?
I really wasn't surprised. As you alluded to, I do believe this is a much more natural election for Kris Kobach. He's going to be even much more comfortable than when he ran for governor. You know, governor is about education. Sometimes it's about roads, potholes, crime, right. You know, local crime, tax rates. And he's very passionate about the border issue. That's a national issue. Last time I checked, Kansas is not on the border. And, you know, look at his Kris Kobach's governor's race. One of the final big TV ads he ran was about the border crisis. So I really think he's going to be much more comfortable running for Senate.
Stephen, Kris Kobach tied himself again very closely to the president of the United States, even saying at one point that he had spoken with the president over the weekend. He said this: "It became very clear to me that the president needs someone who will lead the charge for him in the United States Senate. I don't sense then any daylight between himself and the president. Am I seeing that right?"
No, he very, very closely tied himself to President Trump, more than once saying that he was going to push Trump's policies in the Senate, specifically on immigration issues. He says senators haven't been pursuing enough of what President Trump has proposed. As he put it, senators have sometimes been, quote, dragged along kicking and screaming, I think is how he put it. So, he tied himself to Trump a lot, like we've heard before. He tied himself to illegal immigration, saying he'd clamp down on that. He talked a lot about building a wall on the southern border. He really, it was sort of like Kris Kobach's greatest hits. There are a lot of the big issues we've heard him talk about in the past. And when I heard this event was coming up, I was wondering, is this going to be a new Kris Kobach? Is he going to be talking about different issues? And no, it was a lot of the same things we've heard him talk about before.
But I'm confused, Bob, because Kris Kobach has tried and failed, from what I can tell, to get a post in the Trump administration. So how favorably does the president really regard Kris Kobach?
Oh, Steve, you're asking us to guess the inner workings of Donald Trump's mind.
Yes.
It's very difficult to assess, but I should add that when Donald Trump visited Kansas during the last election, he said basically that he would hire Kris Kobach in a second.
Right.
And Kobach lost, and he actually, you're right, he didn't hire him. That being said, Donald Trump loves people who talk a lot about Donald Trump and support him. It's very difficult to assess the relationship between Kris Kobach and Donald Trump. That being said, Kris Kobach does talk to Donald Trump a lot. Trump loves to talk on the phone to people. So I think this is going to be a campaign, like you've alluded to, again, where Kobach is going to be, you know, joined at the hip with Donald Trump. And that raises questions for a lot of, especially Republicans, who are worried about that, because the third district in Kansas, up there in that Johnson County area,
right,
Wyandotte County,
right,
went for Hillary Clinton last election. And there's a big fear among Republicans that if Kobach is the nominee and he's wedded this closely to Donald Trump, and that he could lose that entire third district. And there's so many votes up there that that could swamp all the votes that a Republican could get in western Kansas.
And of course,
Steve,
Bob,
let me add something there. I think, as you put it, he tried and failed to get a job in the Trump administration. You know, I've heard kind of things differently, that there are jobs there that Kobach could have. They might just not be the highest profile one that Kris Kobach wants. So I think there are opportunities for Kobach to be in the administration. Maybe they just weren't the jobs he wants. He did say yesterday that he's not going to, for now, take a job in the Trump administration. He's going to be focusing on the Senate race.
And we shouldn't forget about the outsized impact that Donald Trump had on Kris Kobach's candidacy for governor less than a year ago right now.
Last-minute endorsement.
Remind us, Stephen.
It was, the day before the primary election. Kobach and then-Governor Jeff Collier were in kind of what looked like a neck-and-neck race, and you know, this wave of I think they were sent out via text message endorsements from Donald Trump. Republicans started getting on their phones messages from Donald Trump endorsing Kris Kobach, and some people say that might have put Kobach over the top, because as we know, he won by only a few hundred votes over Governor Collier.
You know, Stephen, he also seemed to suggest yesterday, Kris Kobach did, that he plans to do a better job at raising money than he did during the governor's race, where he wasn't very good. What does he have in mind?
Well, he didn't get into many specifics, and as people might remember, during the race for governor, when we started looking at the financial reports, we saw that much of his money was coming from his wealthy businessman running mate, Wink Hartman. And then after he lost, there was some criticism that he hadn't focused enough on fundraising or on building kind of a basic get-out-the-vote effort. He was asked about that at the event yesterday, and he kind of brushed that aside and said those criticisms aren't fair, and he said that fundraising is different in a Senate race. And I think, as he put it, we might be surprised by the fundraising numbers he produces.
Bob, you think of Kris Kobach, and for a lot of people, the word controversial immediately comes to mind. Remind our listeners for a couple of points here why Kobach is so controversial.
Well, the main reason Kris Kobach is controversial is that he went into a position, Kansas Secretary of State, and nationalized the issues that that office dealt with. And this includes especially pushing forward new laws on voting and putting a citizenship question. More recently with Donald Trump on the census. But in Kansas, it really was this changing the office of the Secretary of State, and he seemed to be everywhere, and also involving himself in numerous court cases involving the office of Secretary of State, but sometimes not, even getting involved in things and bills in the Kansas legislature involving guns or the environmental laws like the Lesser Prairie Chicken. This was at a time when Sam Brownback, the governor of Kansas, was also really getting some people upset about his policies. And so the Democrats especially, but also some moderate Republicans, really just, it always wasn't about issues. It was really about, when you use that word controversy, it was that Kobach was always at the center of some sort of political storm. And And then by attaching himself to Donald Trump, that basically tripled that qualification.
Well, speaking of political...
Secretary Kobach basically took an office that was largely administrative, mm-hmm. you know, processing voter registrations, business transactions, and as Bob mentioned, really made it about big issues that are somewhat controversial issues. And as he puts it, he never backs down. He doubles down. So when something comes up, Kobach doesn't shy away from controversy.
Yeah. Well, speaking of political storms, I've read that Kobach remains active in efforts to build a wall along the southern border using private dollars, Bob. Do I have that right?
That is correct, and I believe I wasn't at the announcement.
He talked about that a lot at the announcement yesterday.
Right?
So he really touted his work with that group, build and the accomplishments, as he put it, they'd made building some sections of private wall. So yeah, he talked a lot about that.
Well, when Chris Kobach was Secretary of State, and Stephen said the job normally is you're checking voting machines. I mean, you're making sure the county clerks have their training. Kobach was traveling around the United States. In cities, you know, advocating for legislation that would crack down on illegal immigration. And so his passion for years and years has been border security, capturing, deporting illegal immigrants. And this issue has basically been all consuming for him. And so it's, of course, he should run on it when he runs for the U.S. Senate. Hmm.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're talking about a brand new candidacy for the U.S. Senate by Chris Kobach. He announced yesterday up in Leavenworth. If you have a question for our good panel here, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. We're visiting with Bob Beatty. He's a professor of political science at Washburn over in Topeka. Stephen Caranda is also with us, State House Bureau Chief for Kansas Public Radio. We'll talk about a mixed reaction to a candidacy for the U.S. Senate. Bob, I mean, the spokeswoman for the National Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, okay? This is somebody who, in theory, should be in Chris Kobach's back pocket, said this yesterday. Just last year, Chris Kobach ran and lost to a Democrat. Now he wants to do the same and simultaneously put President Trump's presidency and Senate majority at risk. We know Kansans won't let that happen, and we look forward to watching the Republican candidate they do choose win next fall. That doesn't exactly sound like an enthusiastic welcome to the race, Bob.
You're right. That was a remarkable statement.
Remarkable,
from the National Republicans. And I think what it shows is how concerned they are about a possible general election with Chris Kobach as the nominee. National Republicans, they have full-time people studying all these numbers. And as I already mentioned, they know fully well that the 3rd District, again, up in the Johnson County, Wyandotte County of Kansas area, is very volatile, very much. Those voters are very much willing, those Republican voters, very much willing to vote for a Democrat. They threw out their congressman, Kevin Yoder, last year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they're alluding to. I really believe that the National Republicans feel that if they can get just a traditional Republican, you know, even somebody like former Governor Jeff Collier, they're going to win by 15 points. But that's exactly what Kobach is alluding to. Mm-hmm. Kobach is saying the National Republicans are too passive. They want a traditional Republican. And he's saying, I'm different. And of course, we know, yes, he is.
That statement really surprised me as well. And it made me, and this is just my opinion here, looking at it from the outside, it made me think that they really think Kobach could win, because Kobach has a dedicated base, and those are the type of people that vote in Republican primaries. I mean, he was able to unseat a sitting governor. So when I see that statement, I think they see the potential for Kobach to win a divided Republican primary and then maybe have some trouble in the general election. And that's why they're taking these unusual swings right now.
Well, it is interesting, gentlemen, if you expand, you know, this candidacy beyond just the state of Kansas and look what else is going on around the country, Republicans might have an issue because they've got Roy Moore, the highly controversial former Alabama State Supreme Court justice, running for the U.S. Senate down there. And you put, you know, a couple of people who are viewed by some as being way too far to the right, and that begins to paint the entire party.
But that's true. But on the flip side, when you look at the history of elections here in Kansas, it would be such a huge upset for Democrats to win this statewide Senate
race. They haven't
won
one since 1932, right, Stephen?
Correct, yeah. It's been since the 1930s. Well, that's when we last had one in Kansas.
1932, you're right.
So, it's been about 80 years. So it would just be such an upset for Democrats to win that maybe all this hemming and hawing in some ways is a little premature.
And what's this about Kobach's camp misspelling his name on his application for candidacy, Stephen?
He did bring this up and talked about that at the event. What he said was, and for people who didn't see, in a filing before he announced to the FEC, it was spelled C-H-R-I-S, Chris Kobach, instead of his actual spelling, K-R-I-S. And it was quickly amended, and he said that they have a team of people working on things, and whoever filled out that sheet initially just spelled it wrong, and they got it fixed.
That's just not something you want to do, Bob, to start a campaign for the U.S. Senate.
Well, Kobach's had some fun moments over the years, if many people may recall, when he first interviewed with Donald Trump for a high-level position in the Trump administration.
The exposed sheet of paper?
He had a piece of paper with his talking points facing outward toward the cameras, and that got posted everywhere. So, it's always interesting when Kobach runs for office. And some of the old-time politicos that are listening remember Phil Klein, who was the Kansas Attorney General, and there's some similarities there. In terms of how he campaigned as well.
The other thing I'm wondering is, whatever happened to Mike Pompeo? He's the president's secretary of state who is said to have an interest in running for the Senate. And maybe Pompeo's interest, Bob, has been one reason why this race in Kansas has been so quiet, because Republicans are sort of lying back, thinking if Pompeo runs, he has so much name ID, he'll probably win the nomination. So why bother running if he goes? Where's he on this whole thing?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you're exactly right. I remember, one of the original Star Wars where Obi-Wan Kenobi is hovering as a sort of a ghostly presence above everybody. And that's Mike Pompeo. You're exactly right. Here's a bunch of candidates on the Republican side: Jeff Collier, Wink Hartman, Susan Weigel, Alan Cobb, Derek Schmidt,
pretty big name
Roger
candidates.
Marshall, who are sitting there thinking, do I want to spend the next 8 months campaigning, upending my life, raising money, never seeing my kids? And and then I inch ahead of Kobach in a poll. And then a month before the filing deadline, Mike Pompeo jumps in and he's got it.
But Pompeo has kind of tried to tamp down the rumors about him running.
Even if Pompeo says I'm not running, I do believe that come next April, if a poll showed that Kobach was up by 10 and going to get the nomination, I could certainly see him saying, okay, I'll run. And I agree with Steve, with you. I think if his name's on the ballot, he doesn't have to campaign at all. He wins the race.
Stephen, what you were saying about Pompeo, do you expect him to go?
Well, what we've seen before is there were these rumors about him running several months ago, and he kind of tamped them down and said he wasn't going to run. So people are still looking at him, and maybe there's talk behind closed doors. But at this point, he's not even publicly saying, he's weighing it, as far as I'm aware.
I think he'll be weighing it in April.
That's a good. See, this is how things can change. We've seen in the past politicians who say they're thinking about an office or they're not, and then later they announce they're running, saying, "Well, people kept telling me I should do it." So they can always change their mind in the future.
But no question, if Pompeo were to announce today that he's not a candidate, the flurry of activity on the Republican side in Kansas would be over the top, right?
Well, I got to say that I kind of disagree with your thinking that it's been quiet, because we've had so many people saying they're running or considering a run. I mean, we've got, of course, Kobach, but also who have formally announced is the state treasurer, Jake LaTurner, and Dave Lindstrom, former Chiefs player who's well-known in some areas. And then when you look at the list of people who have, said they are considering, it includes former Governor Collier, Senate President Susan Weigel, First District Congressman Roger Marshall. Those are some big names that are, even just them saying they're considering it, I think, is some interest in the race and significant.
Chris Kobach, Bob, would prefer a crowded field?
Well, I'd say no. Right now, there's three people in the race: Jake LaTurner, the treasurer, and then Dave Lindstrom up from Johnson County. Kobach wins that race, I think. So, I think he'd be happy. He'd love it if there was three. The other possibility, though, is if one other candidate emerges, whether it's Jeff Collier, whether it's Susan Weigel, it could be Derek Schmidt, Roger Marshall, but just one of those, then you've got a Kobach versus a big name. Kobach might be in trouble. So then, yes, he would prefer 11 versus 4. Right now, we could have anywhere from 3 to 11. That's really true.
What's a drop-dead date, Stephen, for Secretary Pompeo to announce his candidacy? I mean, does that leave enough time
for
other...
Bob would know the filing deadline better than me next year sometime.
Well, it's 11 months from now.
So there's your drop-dead right there.
the deadline for Mike Pompeo to decide would be 1 minute before...
the filing deadline, yeah.
So it's next June, you're saying, Bob?
Correct.
Next summer is when we... really will have to know.
And just to wrap things up, Stephen, what's happening on the Democratic side? Because there's been a little bit of movement in recent days.
Yeah, and this is what's interesting, is as we were talking about, Democrats haven't won for decades and decades and decades, and in some ways have kind of written off this race in some past elections. But this time we have some actual significant named candidates, former U.S. Attorney Barry Grissom and former Congresswoman Nancy Boida, as well as some others considering. But so there we have, if they both stay in the race, the first, you know, significant Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate in a long time.
Okay, we'll leave our conversation there. We'll see where this thing goes. It's Kansas politics, never a dull moment. Bob Beatty joined us, a political scientist at Washburn University. Bob, always appreciate your time.
Good to be here, Steve.
Stephen Caranda, the State House Bureau Chief for Kansas Public Radio. Stephen, good morning to you.
Thanks.
So good to have you here. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to go fishing with Brent Frazee, the former outdoors editor for the Kansas City Star. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we heard one story of transition. We met a young trans man from Lawrence who's decided to make his physical body match his emotional identity. You can hear that in other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, how the legacy of a chilling murder, that of Emmett Till back in 1955, has altered the physical and cultural landscape of the Mississippi Delta. We meet the Kansas researcher who's collected those stories tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, high water has caused all manner of havoc when it comes to outdoor sports and activities this year. Former Star outdoor writer Brent Frazee reports that a run of nonstop rain this spring has practically stopped fishing in its tracks in Kansas. In fact, he writes that high water closed boat ramps, flooded campgrounds, and left hiking trails in a muddy state of mess at popular reservoirs such as Tuttle Creek, John Redmond, Perry, and Milford. But he also has written that high water hasn't slowed the bass fishing at the Lake of the Ozarks on the Missouri side. Brent Frazee was the outdoor editor for the Kansas City Star for 36 years before retiring. He's the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Outdoor Writers Association of America. Brent, it's always great to have you here. Welcome back.
Hey, great to be back.
So all this flooding, what impact on fishing has it had in these parts?
It's been a mess.
It has been a mess.
I mean... I'm going to ramble, and you can just cut me off when you want to.
But sounds good.
But it's a perfect storm. It really is a perfect storm because not only these reservoirs, their number one priority is flood control. Without these reservoirs there, we would have massive flooding right now.
All over the place.
Yeah. And we have had flooding despite that. The perfect storm I'm talking about is we got the high water. And we got the high water in the Missouri River. Missouri River has been running high all spring and all summer. As a result, these reservoirs that drain into the Missouri River have not been able to release their floodwaters. Mm-hmm. They've had to hold their floodwaters. Again, that's what their intention, that's what their congressional mandate is to control flooding.
Right.
And as a result, these reservoirs, with every rain, they're just going up and up, and they'll frantically try to dump some water in between these storms, but they can't release too much, or else they're going to flood the Missouri River and some of the farm ground there. So
what impact does all this have on fishing?
A big impact.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, at some of these reservoirs, the boat ramps are closed. Mm. They're flooded. You can't even launch a boat. Now, the people who have boats in some of the marinas and everything, they're actually having to shuttle these people back and forth. But the bigger the drainage area, the bigger the drainage area for these reservoirs, the bigger the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Truman Reservoir has a huge drainage area. It's like it's 27 feet high right now.
Wow. Wow.
The thing that just amazes me is Tuttle Creek. Tuttle Creek in Manhattan has a huge drainage area. They're over 50 feet high.
Hmm. And normal for this time of year would be what, roughly?
Normal. They would be normal levels, or in a drought, some of these reservoirs would be down. I mean, so this is very unusual. And you ask me the impact on the fishing. I mean, just think of, like, Truman, how big that reservoir. It's 54,000 acres at normal pool.
Mm-hmm.
When it's 27, 28 feet high, it's almost double the amount of surface acres.
Huh.
And the fish, you're not going to catch the fish where you normally do. The fish will just spread out into all the flooded vegetation and the flooded brush and everything.
Hmm.
And in some cases, get to places where fishermen just can't even get a boat to them. And then you have to figure where you play the guessing game. Where are they going to be in all this?
You don't
cover?
Even know as a fisherman where to go get them.
No, exactly.
Even a veteran like yourself, it's bewildering.
Yeah, well, it is. I
can't help but wonder what this means, for these little mom and pop bait shops and restaurants in the little towns where, near these reservoirs where normally there's a lot of activity and summertime stuff going on. What about those businesses? It's got to be just heck on those businesses.
I feel so sorry for those people. I really do. Now, number one, you think of the human type suffering. I mean, the farmers and that type of thing.
Yeah.
But they don't realize that the recreation areas are hit so hard. I've got friends in the recreation business, and they're struggling. One friend of mine who guides on Clinton Lake, he hasn't been able to get out. Normally, the crappie fishing would be really good right now.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't even been able to get out and take people out. It's like a lost season.
I'm interested, though. You wrote a story it's on your website, brentforz.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a story there about you going to fish down at Lake of the Ozarks for a bass, I think.
Uh-huh.
And it was a little more of an upbeat kind of presentation.
Lake of the Ozarks has benefited.
In what sense?
Several. Number one, they're about the only one that's at normal pool right now.
Hmm.
And people say, well, how can that be?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, because of the landowners, landowners close to the lake, they don't let Lake of the Ozarks flood. So it's getting all this water from Truman through Truman Dam.
Mm-hmm.
Truman Lake is, like I said, is 27 feet high. They're having really heavy water releases to get to lower Truman Lake. That flows into Lake of the Ozarks, and it flows right through Bagnell Dam. They don't let Lake of the Ozarks get high.
Mm-hmm.
So you got this current running through Lake of the Ozarks. People say, well, isn't that dangerous or whatever, being on Lake of the Ozarks? Not at all. I mean, you can't see this current. I was out there like a week and a half ago, and you can't see the current running through there, but it is.
Hmm.
I mean, if you throw a fishing line out, you're going to watch it drift slowly downstream. So fish love current.
Yeah.
Fish love current. And the bass fishing has been really good as a result of the current that's running through Lake of the Ozarks.
I was also thinking it's been a little bit cooler this spring and this summer. What impact does that have on things?
That's not that much of a concern. It
mm-hmm.
really isn't. it hasn't played that big a part. The one thing people always ask me, well, we probably lost a spawn or something because of all this high water. On the contrary, this is the best. This is the one silver lining in this dark cloud. Hmm. This is great. Fisheries biologists will tell you this is great for spawns.
Because
their year classes are always astronomical during flood years. The reason being, all this new cover we're talking about, all these flooded bushes, these flooded trees and things like that, they give the fry a chance to survive. Hmm. I mean, they're very vulnerable. These fry are very vulnerable to predators in normal pool.
Right.
Now they have tons of new hiding places. So
that's interesting.
You know, this is a boon for the fish. We're going to, 3 or 4 years from now, we're going to see the results of this flood. And I would, and one other thing, the only time when that is not a good thing is when the fish come in and make their nests in this newly flooded stuff, and then they pull the water right out from under them.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen this year because, mm-hmm. as I was saying, the core is holding these reservoirs, not releasing a lot of water until now, and it's a perfect situation for, you know, for these new fry to survive.
Brent Frazee is here. He's an outdoor writer, brentfrazee.com. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So how has all this affected your ability to get out and do what you love to do? I mean, are you going out as often as you used to?
You know, I live on a private lake.
I know you do.
In Parkville.
In Parkville, yeah.
And we have not been affected that much. Mm-hmm. We had some high water. And after a rain.
But you like to get out and about, though,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I've had to cancel some trips. And, you know, surprisingly, in this high water, there's been some good fishing at different places. I've got a good friend who's in tourism at Milford Lake. And he said the hybrid fishing, hybrids are a mix of white bass and stripers.
Mm-hmm.
He said it's just been awesome around the bridge piers there and stuff. But again, Milford is like 28 feet high. So,
yeah,
you know, so the problem is getting a boat on the water. If you can get out to one of the marinas and you've got a boat docked there,
then you can go.
You can go.
Did the flooding close any bodies of water to, you know, to recreational boating, Brent, that you're aware of?
You know, for a while it did. Several of the reservoirs were just not necessarily the lake was closed, but you couldn't get to the ramps. I mean, you couldn't. They even had barricades around some of the park entrances.
Wow.
So you couldn't even get to the ramps. So they weren't, the Corps did not officially close them to boating or anything. But again, one other problem here is that even when you can get a boat on, you've got a lot of new hazards in the mm-hmm. water. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got everything from the guardrails around some of the boat ramps or around the bridges to road signs
and logs and
to all kinds of stumps and trees. It's unbelievable the number of the places I've seen where the treetops are the only thing showing just barely above the water.
That's
of pretty tall trees.
Yeah.
It's the worst I've seen it since I've come to Kansas City, and I've been here about 40 years.
Wow. Brent Frazee is here. If you have questions about fishing or boating or getting outdoors and hiking, wildlife, kayaking, he's a guy who can answer your questions. 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Did rivers become too powerful for even professionals to run them? Brent, what have you seen there?
You know, I have not seen, and they did close the Missouri River for a portion of time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, it is so swift right now. I mean, the current, and so big, I don't even see very many people out catfishing or anything like that on the Missouri. Now, the float streams in down south, they're still floating them, like the current. I mean, it's not like the whole state's shut down.
But you can get out and float and have a good time.
You can float and have a really good time. It's a little, the current's a little swifter than normal. These rivers really react a lot more quickly than a reservoir. I mean, you know, even when you get a heavy rain, they'll be up for a while and they'll be murky for a while, but it's not like they stay that way. They, like the current and Jack's Fork and some of those famous float streams, they're still in pretty good shape. I follow on Facebook some friends and they're floating them and having a good time. So I don't want people to have the misconception that the whole state is shut down.
Yeah. Well, if you had to go fishing today, where would you recommend that folks think about going in terms of lakes in either Kansas or Missouri? Where would be the place, if you got to go fishing today, where would you go?
Number one would be Lake of the Ozarks for the reason
you've already said not impacted yet.
Yeah, that has not. Table Rock. Table Rock has, surprisingly, has been kind of immune to all this stuff. I mean, they've had heavy rains down there, and it has climbed somewhat. But right now, I think it's only 4 feet high, and that's very manageable. You can get on boat ramps, you can get to marinas, and the bass fishing has been just really excellent.
At Table Rock,
a friend of mine who's a professional fisherman, he said it's the best spring of bass fishing that he's seen down there at Table Rock for some time. So, you know,
and bass are pretty fun to catch,
too. Oh, they're a blast.
Yeah.
They're a blast.
Because they fight you a little bit,
oh,
right?
They fight really well.
Yeah.
So, in Kansas, the bad thing for the bulk of your listeners, Perry and Clinton are two of the very most popular lakes, and their boat ramps, I checked on the website yesterday, their boat ramps are still closed. The Corps of Engineers boat ramps are still closed because they're so high. So yeah, the sad thing is, like, Clinton is so popular here, especially in the summertime, and it's just been practically unusable. I mean,
that's just amazing.
It's just like a lost recreation season for most of Mid-America.
That's amazing. How about wildlife? I mean, wildlife deer usually give birth, I'm thinking, like in late May, early June. We were still seeing record rainfalls at that point and lower temps. Does that lower a fawn's chance of survival if they can't get warm and dry?
Yes and no. The big thing is deer are very adaptable. Deer are able to, everybody says, oh my God, the deer population is going to be decimated. They're going to drown. No, they've got an uncanny sense of finding high ground.
Okay.
So I'm not so worried about the deer. I think the deer will be fine. I mean, loss of habitat, yes, along these river corridors and everything. I mean, who knows what we're going to find when the water does go down, a lot of lost habitat. But the thing, the critters that I'm most worried about are the ground nesters.
Meaning which ones?
Which would be like especially quail. And we're struggling with quail anyway. But quail are not as adaptable to reach high ground and everything. And I'm afraid we lost a lot of quail nests and a lot of songbird nests and stuff too, because they are ground nesters. Another one that I'm concerned about is wild turkeys. Wild turkeys are pretty tough. They really are, but they're ground nesters, and some of those birds that did lay nests and got flooded out, I don't know how that'll what will happen there.
Turkeys don't go to higher ground like a deer would?
Not as much. I mean, they're hardy animals.
Not as mobile.
Yeah, they're hardy animals, but They don't. The thing with the quail, though, is they'll re-nest. They'll re-nest all the way up into, like, August and things. But, again, is the habitat where they need to lay those eggs, is it going to be there with all this high water? All these farm fields that are just underwater right now, mm-hmm. is when the water does recede, is there going to be enough habitat for them to be productive? I don't know.
What about hiking and camping? I mean, did any state or area parks have to be closed to campers and hikers because of flooding or storm damage?
Parts of almost every state park were closed.
Right?
But that doesn't mean that there weren't high ground campsites still available. But the problem is so many people want to stay by the water's edge when they camp, and they made reservations, you know, months ago for these sites, and they're closed. I mean, they're a muddy mess or underwater. And everybody says, well, when the water goes down, we can camp. It's going to be a long time. I mean, they've got to clean up so much debris. Think of all the logs and all the sawdust and all the mud and stuff. My thing is, and I don't know this myself, where's the money going to come from? I know that there's disaster relief. Is that going to apply to Kansas State Parks? I mean, with how much Kansas State Parks are already strapped financially.
Right.
And
you throw this on top.
What's going to happen? I just wonder how many of those campsites are going to be usable and how long is it going to take before they're back to normal?
Let's go to some phone calls here. And Paul from Johnson County. Paul, you're on with Brent for Z. Good morning.
Yeah, I keep watching this, and every year we have flooding in the same areas on the same rivers and so on and so forth. And I think, well, we can pipeline oil from Alaska all the way to Houston. Why can we not pipeline water from our known flood areas to places that need it, like California, Arizona, and Utah? It seems like a simple fix, but apparently there's no money in water, but there is in oil.
Why not just ship that water somewhere else where it's needed, Brent? Do you have a magic answer for that one?
I really don't. I mean,
it costs a lot of money to build a pipeline down there. Yeah,
that's one thing. And, you know, I just don't know if it's feasible. I mean, you know, the water treatment, we don't even know yet what kind of pollution we've picked up from all these floodwaters covering all these places. Like, I know at Truman, one of the concerns is, and it's a minor concern, I think, but all the outhouses at these bathrooms at these places have been flooded.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's chemicals from fertilizer, from runoff. We have outhouses.
Yeah.
What does that do to the fish population?
I don't think...
I wouldn't want to be a fish in that water.
No, yeah, but the dilution factor is big. But, you know, still, I haven't heard anybody talk about the pollution factor. I know there has been some concerns. I'm wondering if we're just going to have to wait till the water goes down and see what we have.
But it's something that at least has crossed your radar screen
definitely,
here.
Definitely.
Yeah, you're wondering what that might mean. Okay, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Howard from Overland Park. Howard, you're on with Brent. Good morning.
Good morning. This project had started like 30 or 40 years ago of introducing walleye and muskellunge into this area. In general, has it been a success? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Have you been introducing muskies around here?
Yeah, they have. And it's been a success.
I mean, I don't hear about muskies around here.
Oh, Pomme de Terre is one of the best musky lakes in the country.
Where is that?
That's southwest.
Mm-hmm.
Southwest.
I think of Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Yep, exactly. A lot of people do. But we have some good musky fishing, very limited. But we have some good musky fishing. There's like four or five reservoirs in the state
Have you caught a muskie?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's that experience like compared to catching a bass?
Well, here's the thing. The muskie is known as the fish of 10,000 casts. And at my age, I don't want to spend 10,000 casts to catch one fish. You know, I'll do it if I'm getting a story or something like that.
Is it worth 10,000 casts?
Well, some people will say so.
Yeah.
You know, it's a prized catch. It's like a badge of honor for a fisherman. Now, you were talking about walleyes. Walleye stocking has been very successful. I mean, you don't have to go far to find one of the state's best walleye reservoirs in Smithville. Mm-hmm. Smithville has developed into a really good fishery. Stockton Lake is also very good, and they are stocking that with a lot of walleyes. Longview Lake, right here in town, mm-hmm. They've been stocking that, and there's a good walleye population. Bull Shoals on the Missouri Arkansas line is one of my favorites, and summertime walleyes. I mean, drifting in deep water, you can catch a lot of walleyes. So I think walleyes are one of the more exciting developments, but muskies too. We have some muskies in the state.
That's Brent Frazee, outdoor writer extraordinaire. Sure appreciate you taking some time to come in, Brent, and good luck trying to figure all this out going forward the rest of the summer here.
Oh, thanks.
We're almost in mid-July, and here we are talking about high water. It's just unbelievable.
You know, that's what I've been thinking the last few days, how bizarre this is.
It is. Brent Frazee. Tomorrow on the show, we look at postpartum depression in Kansas City and find out what treatment options exist and whether or not they're accessible. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, why the fate of legal medicinal pot in Kansas is not looking so good. Hear that and other conversations at kcur.org/up to date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.